This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is made possible in part each Wednesday by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do, a better business relationship. By Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. By Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. By Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. And by the over 1,000 VBSR members. Here's noted Vermont author David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. On this show, we'll be talking today about investing in the future, but in two very different ways. In our first half hour, we're going to be talking with two women who lead Grounds for Health, a group that has pioneered a low-tech, low-cost, but effective way of treating cervical cancer around the world. In our second half hour, we'll be talking about investing directly and literally in our communities with Will Belongia, the head of the Vermont Community Loan Fund. We'll start here with Grounds for Health. Next month is Cervical Cancer Awareness Month. Cervical cancer remains the number one cause of cancer death for women in low-resource settings, despite the fact that it's nearly 100% preventable. Grounds for Health, based in Waterbury, has pioneered a low-cost screening and treatment for cervical cancer. Since 1996, over 45,000 women have been screened for cervical cancer as a result of Grounds for Health programs. To talk about this, I'm joined by Jane Dale, the Development Director for Grounds for Health, and August Burns, the Executive Director. Welcome, Jane and August, to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you very much, David. We're very happy to be here.
Nice to be here, David.
And the timing could not be more appropriate because...
This is Jane talking, yeah.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, you know, next month, January, is Cervical Cancer Awareness Month. And that's probably news to most of the people who are listening to your program. Cervical cancer is not a disease that has top-of-mind awareness in the West, because we women who live in the West have access to diagnostic tools that keep it from being the major killer that it is in most of the rest of the world. It is a major killer of women globally, and something that can be effectively prevented and treated, and that's what we do at Grounds for Health. August will talk a little bit more about sort of the genesis of our organization and how we're attacking this global killer and how your listeners can get engaged, as we hope all people will, who have the opportunities to be diagnosed and treated here but not elsewhere in the world.
Okay. Now, August, you've been involved in women's health issues for many years. You're the author of a book of Where Women Have No Doctor. It's a healthcare guide for community health workers in developing countries that's been translated into 40 languages. And you've also been a contributor to Our Bodies, Ourselves. August, why is cervical cancer such a big killer, especially in the developing world?
Thanks, David. The cervical cancer is, as we now know, which we didn't know 10 or 20 years ago, exactly the cause of it, but we know the cause. It's the human papilloma virus, and it is a common virus that almost anyone who has a sexual life will encounter at some point in their lifetime. And for, you know, most of history, it was a virus that could turn into cervical cancer. We didn't know that. And in the United States and in most Western countries, they found a way to just test for it, and that was the pap smear. So it remains a common virus, a common viral infection. And in developing countries, there's no screening programs that are effective in order to catch the early changes that can easily be treated and prevent the cancer from developing.
So how did a group in Waterbury, Vermont, come to be involved in treating cervical cancer in the developing world?
Okay, it's a great story. Our founder, Dan Cox, who now owns Coffee Enterprises up in Burlington, was on a buying trip in Mexico in 1996, and he happened to be traveling with an old doctor friend, literally old. He was retired OBGYN, who went in about his usual business of finding an OBGYN locally and finding out what was going on for women. And he learned that cervical cancer was a leading cause of death for women of reproductive age in the community. And he was outraged. He said, this is wrong. And Danny, you need to do something about it. So Dan, being very well connected, called Ben and Jerry and folks at Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, raised some money and got started. And that was, what is it now? I don't know. 17 years ago. And what started as a very nice community effort of a few folks going down and doing some screening programs has now evolved into a global project that is, we're in four countries, and as you said, more than 45,000 women have received screening. But more importantly, we're a training organization now that builds capacity of doctors and nurses to be able to provide those services in their own communities.
So talk a little bit about that. On your website, it notes that Grounds for Health educates communities in the single visit approach, mm-hmm. which has proven to be the most effective way to screen right. for and treat cervical cancer. What is that?
Well, the exciting thing is that about 20 years ago, the World Health Organization noted that this was a leading killer of women, and in many, many developing countries, it kills more women than pregnancy and childbirth. We know that maternal mortality remains a huge problem, and yet cervical cancer is greater. But it was a silent killer. Nobody was paying attention. And the screening programs that were tried were based on the Western model of pap smears, and it just didn't work. The infrastructure and support that's needed for such a technologically intensive program just didn't exist. So they said, we need to do it, something. And the Gates Foundation provided, I think it was $153 million in funding to find an alternative. And out of that funding came the HPV vaccine, which I think is very well known in the United States now. Most girls are being encouraged to be vaccinated. Most families are being encouraged to vaccinate their daughters. Very simple sort of revival of an old screening tool that actually Dr. Fote, who was that original doc who went to Mexico, used to use in the 1950s, which is a simple screening method using vinegar, which causes a response of abnormal cells and allows us to visibly see that there's cell changes there.
Just, we're talking about common white vinegar.
Yes, common white vinegar. And they also developed a HPV test, which is now also available mostly in Western countries because of cost. So, you know, they came up with a solution. And the single visit approach is using the common white vinegar to just wash the cervix. Take a look. You see white areas and you freeze it immediately right there on the spot. Freezing causes no pain and is 90% effective in destroying abnormal cells. So it's remarkably effective. As a matter of fact, studies have shown that if women were to receive one screening in their lifetime between the ages of 35 and 45, we could reduce the rate of cervical cancer by 30%. Bingo. You know, costs about 23 cents in materials to screen a woman. It's not a big ticket price at all. It's more effective than a pap smear, and as simple as it could be. We train doctors. It takes us about 7 days of a training, intensive training program to train doctors and nurses to be able to identify these changes and learn the techniques for freezing the cervix. So very quickly we can bring these programs into working order. It's amazing.
We're talking this week on the Vermont Conversation with Jane Dale and August Burns from Grounds for Health. You can join the conversation by calling us at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. So describe one of your many field trips where you go, and which are the four countries that you're in, and describe one of your recent visits.
Sure. We have recently completed 17 years in Mexico. We're currently working, have active projects in Nicaragua and Peru. Have just completed a very successful program in Tanzania and are about to begin working in Ethiopia. So describing our program in Nicaragua, we have been there for about 7 years. We've been in maybe three different communities during that time. And by communities, I mean a municipality that encompasses, you know, tens of thousands or 100,000 people. So not to say that we cover all of that distance. And let me just step back. We work in partnership with coffee cooperatives, and they are our partners. They invite us to the communities because they know that healthcare is important, and they see women dying of this disease. And they support us through logistics, community trust, building bridges with the local ministries of health. So a typical trip would be we have staff on the ground who are maintaining those relationships and working with communities. They would be out in the communities doing training of community health promoters who would then go out and recruit the right women to come in. We only see women between the ages of 30 and 50 or who are at highest risk of precancerous lesions. We'd like to see women who have not been seen before ever or not in a number of years for a screening test. So those women would be invited to come to a campaign, which means an appointment. We'll see about 250 or 300 women in a campaign over a period of 3 or 4 days. And the week before that, we'll have a crew of doctors, 10 to 12 to 15 doctors and nurses, who are recruited from local health centers that pertain to those rural, poor communities that the coffee cooperatives work in and people live in. And we'll be training them in this technique. So women will be screened, they will be treated, and we'll see a few hundred women during that period of time. So our program trips would include volunteers from the United States, doctors and nurses who volunteer to come with us and act as mentors and preceptors, helping to train the local doctors and nurses to provide the services.
How do you measure the impact that you've had?
Well, the first thing is to the look on women's faces and the stories that they tell. I remember sitting in Tanzania in an area where we were working. There had never been any screening of anyone before. This is a place where I would call it where there is no speculum. No GYN services really available. And we started up a program, and we wondered if these women who were from very traditional tribal regions would even come. We tried to recruit 300 women, 750 signed up, and we had to manage that. But afterwards, I was sitting in there were a group of women waiting for a ride home, and I asked them what they thought, and, you know, it is a GYN exam, and they looked at us and they said, we were met with love, and they just were touched that somebody cared, that this service had been made available to them, and they were very, very happy. So that's a measure of success in the human form. A measure of success for us is that the doctors and nurses that we have trained continue to do the work, and tens of thousands of women are now receiving screening that were never screened before. That's a great measure of success.
Do you have some sense that in the areas where you've operated of the incidence of cervical cancer, going down or progressing to an more advanced stage going down?
We really can't track that. Mortality rates are tracked, in large population samples over a long period of time. What we know from extrapolating on the evidence is that if women receive screening, but more importantly, treatment of the precancerous lesions that are detected, we know that a large portion of them will self-resolve at that point after treatment. And we do see them a year later. And the results are what we would expect statistically, that about 90% of them have no signs of abnormality at that point, and we can consider them successful treatment of precancer. One of the amazing things of the model that we have learned is working with community. One of the biggest problems in developing countries for all issues and diseases is that populations are very vulnerable. So they only come when they have a serious acute problem. Prevention programs are very difficult to institute. When you're poor, you've got mouths to feed and, you know, sick children, or you need to work in the fields, you're not going looking for tests for problems you don't have. The community brings women in. The community cares. Women who have positive results or suspicious for cancer or frank cancers are then followed up by their communities because they want them to live. They care about them. They're part of the community. And that has been, that's really a huge learning and probably one of the most important lessons learned that we have to share with the world.
So just to give a sense of, you know, if you see 100 women, how many have precancerous lesions?
Okay. So you would expect that in 100 women, probably one woman out of 100 would develop cancer, cervical cancer, if she had not been screened and treated. Our test results are about 10%. Of the women who we screen will have a positive result because the test, though very sensitive, is not very specific for cancer. And that's true of pap smears as well. So we have about a 10% positivity rate. And so, and out of that, we will prevent one death from cervical cancer.
Hmm. Jane Dale, you're the development director at Grounds for Health. Who supports this? I know Green Mountain Coffee Roasters has been a big benefactor of Grounds for Health. So tell me about their role and the role of other coffee companies.
Right. Well, the fact that we were started by a coffee buyer really has put the organization squarely in the coffee world. And the coffee community has been unbelievably philanthropic in supporting this work, partly because they recognize that it's the right thing to do. These women shouldn't be dying from a preventable disease at the height of their productivity, but also because of the key role that women play in the coffee industry. Probably many people don't realize that more than 70% of all the coffee that's picked, and it's picked by hand, is picked by women and sorted by women. And so these are very key players in the coffee world. And coffee companies have come to understand that there's not only a humanitarian imperative, but a business imperative. So you mentioned Green Mountain Coffee. We're right in the shadow of Green Mountain Coffee here in Waterbury. And they have been our largest supporter by far for all the years that we have been doing this work. But through their influence and through the outcome of the work that we've done, through the success that we've had, we've been able to bring in 200 coffee companies from all over the country who, again, have seen both the humanitarian need to help these women, but also the business implications of not helping them. And in recent years, particularly in the last 2 years, we have seen a real emergence, too, of just individuals, whether they be women of wealth or families or men who just see that this is something from a social justice perspective that people can support. They don't need to support it with millions of dollars. They can support it with hundreds or thousands of dollars and truly have an impact on the lives of women on the other side of the globe. So we're really encouraging more individuals to get engaged, even as we talk more to the coffee industry about maintaining or even increasing their level of support.
August Burns, you were going
to
add?
Yeah, and I'd like to add that one of the ways that I try to talk to about this to people here in the United States, where, you know, 11,000 women a year die of cervical cancer in the United States. Very small number. And that's because we've got a great system of prevention. 500,000 women die globally, and most of them in developing countries. So I always say, you know, breast cancer is a cancer that touches most American families. If you could have prevented breast cancer in that loved one who you have known that breast cancer has touched for 23 cents, and it could have been detected before it became a cancer, when it's in its pre-change stage, wouldn't it be great that somebody would have done that? And these are mothers.
Yeah. So let me ask about that. In the domestic side, you mentioned the HPV vaccine that is relatively recent here. Some people know it as Gardasil. There's another one out there as well. How big a deal is that? Because for a lot of parents, it's not something they grew up with or heard about. Mm-hmm. And I know some parents are concerned about giving another vaccination.
It's a major public health breakthrough. Again, cervical cancer is the leading cause of death for women of reproductive age in the majority of countries in the world. And here in the United States, the cost of screening of all women in the United States through repeat pap smears is a phenomenal strain on the healthcare system. The Gardasil vaccine, Cervarix is the other one, are both equally effective, and they will protect 100% of against 70% of the viruses that cause cervical cancer, and would prevent 70% of all cervical cancer from happening. So worldwide, we could just drop these numbers dramatically, and hopefully a even more effective vaccine will come about. The controversy around the vaccine is not about physical concerns. I think it has been well proven that it's safe and very effective. It really is more of a social issue that has grown up in the United States and doesn't exist in other countries, where the coverage rates for the HPV vaccine for girls is very, very high, such as in Australia and Europe. And they're tracking the effectiveness, they're tracking problems with it, and it's considered very, very safe and very, very effective. So I'm hoping that it's a momentary kerfuffle, and that we'll get over it, and it'll just be part of the vaccine possibilities for children in this country.
And it's now being recommended for boys as well.
It may be being recommended for boys. The argument against that is just that it doubles the cost of two programs without as, you know, nearly as big an impact. That the big impact is by vaccinating girls.
So you have pioneered this approach in four countries, but this is also being scaled up globally,
yes,
throughout Africa and other mm-hmm. developing countries. What are we finding out about that there, and what role has Grounds for Health played as sort of an incubator of this approach?
We like to call ourselves a catalyst. The world is doing this now. We are going to see an end to cervical cancer, and it's really exciting to be part of a major public health breakthrough. And we will be playing a role in providing technical assistance to countries and regions on how to get this up and running through publications of our success. And the role that we really play and will continue to play is the importance of getting it out to women at the end of the road. It's really easy to, especially in developing countries where resources are so constrained, to get things started in urban areas, and the poor in the countryside just never get the benefit. We find that starting out there at the end of the road brings resources there, and then everyone benefits.
Jane Dale, I'm going to give you the last word. You mentioned that you're encouraging individuals to contribute. How can people who want to contribute to your efforts do that?
Yeah, thanks, David. We encourage people to look at our website, which is www.groundsforhealth.org. You can make a donation right on the website. also would like people to think about spreading the word about this global issue, because it is going to be the focus of January Cervical Cancer Awareness Month, and possibly even ask your coffee shop, your favorite coffee shop, if they're involved, and if not, you know, would they like to become involved? There are thousands of coffee shops all over the country, and if every one of them would take this on, it would be a great, great boon to this disease.
Okay, well, great to have you both here. August Burns, Executive Director, and Jane Dale, Development Director from Grounds for Health.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Looking for a loan for your Vermont business, childcare, or nonprofit organization? Look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Because at the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we lend to Vermont businesses and nonprofits, even if the bank says you're not quite ready for a loan. At the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we focus on people, not profits. We'll work closely with you before and after you get your loan to make sure you get what you need to succeed. The Vermont Community Loan Fund makes loans to early stage companies and established businesses ready to take the next step. We lend to farms and food producers, high-tech businesses, manufacturers, retailers, childcare businesses, affordable housing developers, service providers, and other nonprofit organizations. We make loans to Vermonters doing business right here at home and around the world. So if you're looking for financing to help your growing business, look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Visit us online at investinvermont.org. That's investinvermont.org.
AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire. Newtown, Connecticut police have released the 911 recordings of landline calls from inside Sandy Hook Elementary School.
Newtown 911, what's the location of the emergency?
Sandy Hook School. I think there's somebody shooting in here at Sandy Hook School.
Okay, what makes you think that?
Because somebody's got a gun. I saw a glimpse of somebody. They're running down the hallway.
Okay.
Well, they're still running. They're still shooting. Sandy Hook School, please.
In the minutes that followed, staff members pleaded for help.
There's still shooting going on, please.
All right, what about injuries at this time?
Excuse me?
What about injuries at this time?
I don't know of any injuries right now.
Sadly, that was not the case, as Adam Lanza shot and killed 20 children and six school staff members before killing himself last December 14th. The 911 tapes were posted on the town's webpage when a judge ordered their release over objections of prosecutors after a legal challenge by the Associated Press. AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire.
You have water damage or soot damage? Call SR Services in Montpelier. They're the experts. Don't get discouraged if your home has been damaged by water from flooding or a leaky roof. SR Services has the equipment and expertise to restore the appearance of your home to like new again. They work on tile and grout floors, too. Gray grout lines will be white again thanks to SR Services. For water and smoke damage or professional carpet cleaning, call SR Services at 223-6577. SR Services, 407 Barry Street in Montpelier, 223-6577.
Kingdom County Productions presents A Cape Breton Christmas with Natalie McMaster, 7 p.m. Wednesday, December 4th, Barry Opera House. Grammy-winning fiddler Natalie McMaster's many collaborators include Alison Krauss, Carlos Santana, Paul Simon, Pavarotti, and Yo-Yo Ma. Natalie McMaster's performances showcase foot-tapping rave-ups, heart-rending ballads, fiddling fireworks, and world-class step dancing for audiences of all ages. That's Natalie McMaster, Wednesday, December 4th, Barry Opera House. Tickets at the Barry Opera House box office or by calling 476-8188 or online at barryoperahouse.org. Don't miss Natalie McMaster, December 4th in Barry, presented by Kingdom County Productions, with sponsorship support from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Vermont, Community National Bank, and WDEV Radio Vermont. Tickets and information at kingdomcounty.org.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility makes the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman available each Wednesday, along with People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow. Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. and Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business, as well as over 1,000 plus VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. In this half hour, we'll continue on the theme of investing in the future, but now taking a much more local and literal approach. The Vermont Community Loan Fund has, for a quarter of a century, been providing loans, grants, and support services for affordable housing, local businesses, child care providers, and community organizations. And it's recently reached a couple of milestones. First of all, in the last quarter, it gave more money away than it has ever done in its history, over $3 million. And just this morning, the organization got an award from the U.S. Small Business Administration as the top micro lender in Vermont. Our guest this half hour to talk about the Vermont Community Loan Fund is its executive director, Will Belongia. Will, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Oh, thank you, David. Thanks for having me here.
Well, let's start with the award that you got this morning. And first, explain to us, what is a micro lender?
Sure. We were honored this morning by the U.S. Small Business Administration as the top micro lender in Vermont. And so a micro lender is for the SBA, for the Small Business Administration, it's really about financing, lending money to very small businesses, mostly sole proprietorships. And lending them very small amounts and coupling that with technical assistance and other business help. And we did a lot of them this year.
So this is a term we're used to hearing about in developing countries, the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh and other places. So listeners might be surprised to hear that it's done here. How is it done differently in Vermont than, say, in a developing country?
Yeah, there is still a scale issue even in Vermont and in the United States versus in some of the lesser developed countries. Scale being just size. You know, it's while we do $1,000, $2,000 loans, our average loan size in the microloan program is $20,000. Some of the other micro lenders in the state's loan size might be closer to 10. And nationally, I think the average for the SBA micro loan program is probably around $10,000. Lesser developed countries, they do a lot of $500, $1,000, even
$100. $50.
Yeah. There's still a scale that's a little
different. Yeah, $50 and $100 doesn't get you a lot in the U.S.
Yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit about the history of the Vermont Community Loan Fund. So you're 25 years old.
25 years old, yeah. We started up in 1987, a group of Vermonters at around a picnic table at Goddard College. They were at a conference at Goddard College talking about divestiture from South Africa. Uh-huh. And got together and said, okay, we're telling a bunch of people that we should divest from South Africa. Are we going to tell them what they should invest in? And they said, yeah, we should do that. We should make an opportunity. If we're telling them to move their money out, we should give them something to move it into. And so around that picnic table, a bunch of Vermonters got together and said, let's create this nonprofit that's going to be a statewide revolving loan fund. They really, at that point, had very little. These weren't wealthy people thinking about this. They were, they had some ideas of where the money might come from to be able to lend to Vermont businesses and nonprofits. And created in 1987 the Vermont Community Loan Fund.
So, how are you different than a small Vermont business can go to a bank and get a loan? How are you different?
Well, one of the things that around the work of the Vermont Community Loan Fund is we have, we do know that there is obstacles to many folks being able to access capital, whether it's to be able to access the money to start a business, to a nonprofit to help with their operations or their facilities, or whether it's an affordable housing developer in trying to cobble together all the financing that's needed to develop an affordable housing project. And that banks serve a great role for the vast majority of folks looking for capital. But there are a lot of folks who just don't qualify with a bank. So the Vermont Community Loan Fund is able to take more risk than a bank. It's able to be more flexible in our loan terms, more patient in our lending. And the biggest reason why that's the case is the blend of public and private dollars that we raise and that we use to make those loans. We bring in millions from the government, from outside Vermont, from the United States Department of Agriculture, Small Business Administration, Agency of Commerce, U.S. Treasury. And we blend that, we combine that with Vermonters' support, Vermonters who lend us money, that we're able to, with that combination of kind of Vermonters wanting to use their own money or have their money used to invest in their local communities, with bringing in public dollars from the government, we're able to provide that flexible capital, that risk-taking capital that a bank is unable to.
We're talking today on the Vermont Conversation with Will Belongia, the Executive Director of the Vermont Community Loan Fund. You can join the conversation at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Will, can you give me an example of a couple of your people who borrow?
Sure, yeah. You know, a real famous one that's been in the press lately is Vermont Smoke and Cure. They're a wonderful business that started up in Barrie that creates processing pork, summer sausage, bacon, ham, pepperoni, really high quality, delicious bacon stuff. And in 2005, they were part of the Farmer's Diner, which was a diner idea of how to bring local foods into a diner kind of establishment, retail establishment. They split off in 2006, and the Vermont Community Loan Fund helped finance that split with Vermont Smoke and Cure kind of as a standalone entity. At that time, their sales were $370,000. Today, they're $3.7 million. So 7 years, a 10-fold increase in sales. They've just recently expanded. They received capital from a bank, amongst other kind of capital sources. But I think Community National Bank came in to help with their expansion. And in some ways, that's an example of where VCLF plays. We went in 2006 as really the only debt into that project, the only entity that was willing to help finance their growth. 7 years later, we still have a loan with them. 7 years later, they're able to expand, get bank financing, able to attract traditional finance. And they went from a 3,300 square foot facility to a 20,000 square foot facility in their expansion.
What did you see in them? What made them a prime candidate for the Vermont Community Loan Fund?
So in a community, they were a processor providing good jobs. They had a really good product. And this is not always the best method of underwriting a loan or figuring out if you want to lend a loan, but especially to someone who's making a product, if it's good, if I like it.
So you like their bacon?
It's good bacon. And and sausage and pepperoni. It's all. I'm not a vegetarian. I like what they make. As does my son, Sawyer. He likes their bacon a lot too. But you know, we look at them. They have a great product, a good vision. They have talent in their staffing, with a vision that's able to put that vision and convey it to someone like me who doesn't know anything about processing pork, and convey that vision and how they're going to be successful. And we're able to, you know, this is the being able to pull that public money and the private Vermonters' money and blend it. This is the flexibility. We're able to look at collateral and cash flow and management capacity and the character of the borrower, and the product. And, you know, some things were not great. Some things were really good. We didn't need them all to be wonderful. So that was real nice. And, you know, I do want to say that being able to transition them so that they're now attractive to a bank is a great, in some ways, that's a success. That's a measure of success for the Vermont Community Loan Fund.
Hmm. Well, we have a caller on the line, Bob from Marshfield. Welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Hi, thanks a lot. I'm Bob Light. We have Hollister Hill Farm. We're a member of the Vermont Community Loan Fund. They have helped us tremendously. Quite a few years ago when we were getting into retail meats from our farm and having our bed and breakfast, none of the banks wanted to take us on. They figured we were a bad risk. We had built up quite a bit of debt from being full-time dairy farmers at one time. They told us that there was no way that we could pull out of that, that we could not be successful in what we wanted to do. And we went to Vermont Community Loan Fund. They sat down with us, and they said, you know, we think what you want to do will work. And they financed us, and we've been with them ever since. We've had several loans with them, and we pay our mortgage off every month right on time. And we think that Vermont Community Loan Fund is a tremendous asset to Central Vermont, to Vermont, and to farmers, because so many lending institutions will not lend to a farmer. It's just one of those things. They just figure that if you're a farmer, you're not going to succeed.
Why didn't they lend to you, Bob? Why didn't the regular banks lend to you? What did they tell you?
Well, number one, like I said, that we had built up a fair amount of debt by being dairy farmers, and that we were still carrying that debt, and we needed to make provisions for paying off that debt over a period of time. And we knew that we could do that if they would give us a chance to show them that what we wanted to do, we could do it, that we were good people and we were hard workers, and that we were capable of doing that. But none of the banks, even today, you go to a bank, and we bank at Northfield Savings Bank. And I sat down with them, and they said, Al Fleury said, look, you know, you've been the customer for hours, for years, we've known you, but we just don't do business with farms, period.
Well, Will Belanger, can you say something about, I don't know if you know Bob Light's situation, but what about doing business with farms, which, as Bob said, it's very common for them to have very high levels of debt?
Yeah, we do a lot of financing in agriculture. We don't do a lot of operating dairy farms. But before I go on, Bob, thanks for your call. And that makes me feel good.
Well, thank you. You've been a tremendous help to us. So it's a two-way street.
Well, maybe I should just ask, Bob, before we let you go, can you just tell me what you got from the loan fund and what you did with it?
Well, first of all, we had a mortgage with another institution, and it wasn't a bank, and they wanted to go in a different direction of where they were going, and they wanted to get a lump sum of money so they could do that. And one of the ways that they could do that was to sell our mortgage, and that's what we tried to do. And we went to the different banks and said, here, you know, we have this mortgage, and we'd like you to buy it, and we'll go forward. And they all said no. But Vermont Community Loan Fund said yes. you know, we'll do this with you. And so they gave us, they have the primary mortgage on our farm. And then we wanted to expand our business here, which we have a farm store where we sell pork and beef and chickens and raw milk and maple syrup, etc. But we needed to expand that to be able to go forward. And Vermont Community Loan Fund had this agritourism money available. I think that came through Bernie Sanders, if I'm not mistaken. And we were able to borrow an additional $50,000 from them to expand our farm store here. And without that money available to us, we would never have been able to do that. And we probably wouldn't be in business today if it wasn't for that, and if it wasn't for the Vermont Community Loan Fund.
Okay. So, well, Bob, thanks for sharing that story with us.
Yeah, thanks, Bob.
And thank you, too. Have a good day.
So, Will Belanger, Executive Director of the Vermont Community Loan Fund, put that in a little context. He mentioned Bernie Sanders got some of the money for that. What's the story behind Bob's experience?
Yeah, Bob had a interesting experience. I'm recalling, as he's talking about this, I am recalling the deal that he had. The first loan was, yeah, it was held by, it was a, someone had made him a loan, a private individual who then donated the loan to a nonprofit. The nonprofit, I may get this wrong, Bob, so forgive me if I don't quite get it. The nonprofit didn't really have, they didn't know what to do with this. It was given to them. And so they all came to us and we said, sure, we'll give the nonprofit, we'll pay for that asset and we'll just, we'll take on the loan. And so, that worked as a, just as a transaction, it seemed to work. We were able to get comfortable with the Hollister Hill bed and breakfast. It's a bed and breakfast as well. Bob and Lenora kind of went from a dairy farm to a bed and breakfast, and then they had their, as he talked about, their, some of their pork and their chickens farm store there. The next one is they came to us is they realized the bed and breakfast wasn't in and of itself going to cash flow both the debt that we now held as well as their being able to live. And they didn't want to sell off, and I think there were some conservation easements on the land. They didn't want to sell off the land, which is a big struggle for a lot of farmers who especially get out of dairy farming. Is
they now sit on very valuable real estate.
They sit on real estate without the income to, they're stuck.
Yeah.
They get stuck. So they came to us wanting to expand kind of how to increase the revenue from their farm store. And so we had a pot of money. It's one of those pieces of public dollars that we've brought into the loan fund. This was a pot of money Representative Congressman Sanders, now Senator Sanders, but at the time Congressman Sanders, brought into Vermont through the United States Department of Ag to help. It was a maybe $1 million. A chunk of it went to Vermont Farms to help with just kind of to create greater agritourism businesses to increase the Vermont kind of ag tourism revenues broadly for the state. And there was a small bit for a loan fund, which we then took and still use it to make low interest rate loans, 3%, 4% loans to folks who want to bring people onto their farm to purchase things. So it's farm stands. It's there's a Fat Toad Farm up in Randolph Brookfield that's doing goat's milk caramel, and they sell a lot. They sell a lot of it at the farm. So it's how to bring tourists onto a farm and purchase things.
Right. Let me ask you, Will Belanger, the in the aftermath of Tropical Storm Irene in 2011, this was a financial crisis among many crises that people faced. What role did the Vermont Community Loan Fund play in the recovery?
Right. You know, you're right in that Irene created tremendous financial pressures and stresses on lots of communities, individuals, businesses, families. And the process of addressing that, some things were quick. The Vermont Economic Development Authority which is a state, kind of a quasi-state entity, had a great loan program to provide really quick loans with pretty flexible terms to businesses. There were some very agonizing processes, whether it be insurance or FEMA or a whole bunch of processes. And in the mix, you know, the Vermont Community Loan Fund really was in the mix. We had several businesses that, had losses and didn't have enough insurance, enough FEMA, enough to recover from that. So an example, there was a furniture maker that got flooded. And, you know, their solution was, we need to move our facility. Our current facility wasn't really working great for us before, and now that it's been flooded, we don't want to be there again. But one of the tragic things about Irene is it happened in the midst of the housing crash and the financial collapse. There was tightening of bank credit. There was there was lots of other things that were still impacting Vermont, even as Irene hit. And so there was less resources in many ways for some of these businesses. So the loan fund did step up with several businesses. We helped finance a couple that were existing borrowers of the loan fund that got impacted, a restaurant in Wilmington, a farm, a childcare center, all that got, particular impacts. And in one case, we were bridging insurance. In another case, it was just costing them more than the insurance and FEMA were going to pay. And so we actually went in and added more capital into the restaurant. We just saw some businesses that weren't existing borrowers of the fund who had bank relationships, who had, but at the time, and this comes back to just the environment that we were operating in then, was that a lot of capital was unavailable to small businesses. Probably in many cases because the couple of years beforehand during the economic recession, they weren't making money.
Right.
They weren't profitable, and so they weren't attractive to a traditional bank.
So, people drive down Main Street, they see the nice storefronts, or they're on the web and they see the nice website of a business, but you're actually a little bit of the magic behind the storefront and the website about how those places got there. What do you like about your job?
Oh. I was just talking to someone at the award ceremony for the Small Business Administration about what I still get excited about. And one of them is it's Bob at Hollister Hill. It's the lights there. It's the folks that we're helping. It's the businesses. It's going to the goat farm and seeing them make the caramel, and trying it, because I do end going to smoking chair, getting bacon. It's delicious. I really enjoy that. And then I enjoy.
Okay, well, just to finish here, for people who want to either give or borrow, what's the website?
Sure. www.investinvermont.org.
Okay. Well, Will Belange, Executive Director of the Vermont Community Loan Fund, thanks for joining us this week.
Thank you, David.
You have been listening to the Vermont Conversation with host David Goodman. tune in next Wednesday when once again, Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and its over 1,000 VBSR members, along with Fairpoint Communications, small business owners, make it big with Fairpoint, National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow, People's United Bank, find out what know-how can do, and Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to patient, community, and medicine since 1879, as well as Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. These all help to bring you David Goodman with this special program.
You are listening to the stations of Radio Vermont, 96.1 WDEV FM and Warren, FM 96.5 Barrie, AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier, and serving the kingdom on FM 101.9 from Island Pond. It's 2 o'clock.
AP Radio News.